This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rashida Jones, stars with Bill Murray in the new movie On the Rocks, which was just nominated for a Critics' Choice Award for Best Comedy. It was written and directed by Sofia Coppola and draws on Coppola's relationship with her famous father, Francis Ford Coppola. Jones made a Grammy Award-winning documentary about her famous father, Quincy Jones. Her mother, Peggy Lipton, starred in the series The Mod Squad. Rashida Jones co-starred in 7 seasons of the NBC comedy series Parks and Recreation as Ann Perkins. She had a recurring role for 2 seasons of The Office as Jim's girlfriend. Jones now co-stars with Kenya Barris in the Netflix series Black AF and co-hosts a podcast with Bill Gates. In On the Rocks, she plays Laura, a successful writer who's been unable to complete her latest book. She's been at home in Manhattan raising her 2 young daughters and doing the cooking and housework while her husband has been traveling a lot, getting his new business off the ground. She feels stuck and taken for granted, which is eating away at her self-confidence. Although she can't even admit it to herself, she thinks her husband may be having an affair with his new coworker. She starts to confide in her father, Felix, a successful art dealer who seems to know everyone important in Manhattan and constantly talks with his daughter about what men are really like, as if he were some kind of anthropological scholar of masculinity. He offers that in part as an explanation for his many affairs, which was the reason Laura's mother divorced him. When Laura tells her father, Felix, about her husband's constant travel and his latest trip, Felix comments that the hotel her husband stayed in is not a place you would stay if you were on a business trip, and suggests it would be a good place for an affair. Laura denies that possibility at first. Here's Bill Murray and Rashida Jones.
There was something.
What?
Never mind.
What?
There were some of his co-workers' toiletries in his luggage.
Sloppy move.
But she couldn't put them in her carry-on through security, so he offered to put them in his luggage. That's it.
Raise your hand if that sounds fishy.
You know what? I shouldn't have said anything. Forget it.
Have you checked his phone?
No.
Well, do yourself a favor. Check his text messages. If it's, I mean, it may come to nothing, but, you know, may as well make sure.
Dean is not like you. He's a nerd. He's a good guy, a great dad.
He's a man. It's nature. Males are forced to fight, to dominate, and to impregnate all females. I remember the first time I saw your mother. It was a beach party. Back then, all the girls wore bikinis. Your mother walked out of the ocean in a white one-piece swimming suit. And that was it for me. I was done. Staying on track, what does Dean have planned for your birthday?
He's not going to be here for my birthday.
What kind of guy forgets his wife's birthday?
He didn't forget. He has a work trip, but we're going to celebrate when he gets back.
That's not the same. I traveled. I never missed a birthday.
Right, but you had some other shortcomings.
Like what?
Rashida Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on our show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
As a father and as a man, Bill Murray's character is often really charming and charismatic, but he's kind of insufferable and out of touch when it comes to anything related to gender. What do you say to a man like that of another generation who's in your life, whether it's a father or an uncle or a friend of your father's or whatever? I mean, you're fond of them and with your father, you love him. You don't want to kind of lecture him on gender, or do you? I mean, I had issues with my father who grew up in the generation of like women drivers.
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous. So, you know, how do you deal with it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think what's so lovely about this movie is it doesn't really answer that question, because the truth is, I think it's okay to live in the middle where you love somebody who has completely different perspective on the world because they just grew up at a completely different time. And I think there's kind of tender ways and ins where you can talk to them about it. And then there's times that you just can't and you have to sort of let it be background noise, because the truth is, at a certain age, people probably don't change and won't change. But, you know, I think in this film, she has had enough. And, you know, the kind of climax of the film is she just lets it all spill out because she has held her tongue for so long, or she's rolled her eyes, or she's, you know, just looked the other way. And eventually there's just a couple of theories that she just, that just don't sit well with her. And she has to let him know that and let him have it a little bit. So I think, you know, it is, it's that kind of thing. It's like, what are the non-negotiables? Like, if you can just decide, like, that's something that I literally can't hear anybody say, including my father. I won't let him say that I'm going deaf to women's voices. That's just not something that's acceptable in my presence. And then the other things, like, I just have to let them roll off because they're never going to change.
So you never say to your father, you're part of the patriarchy.
Oh, what, you mean in the movie or in real life?
In real life.
In real life, no. When I talk to my dad, sometimes I'm like, don't say that. You can't say that. But I also love him. And I, you know, it's followed up with a hug and a kiss.
You made this film shortly after your mother died and your son was born. To lose a mother and become a mother so close together must have been such an emotional experience.
Yeah, this has been a very emotionally intense couple of years. I know, obviously, for a lot of people this past year, but even right before this movie, you know, I mean, it was sort of like back to back to back to back, just wrenching, pulling my heart in all different directions. And yeah, I for a moment, you know, thought about maybe not doing the movie because it was so close to when my mom passed away, and I was in grief shock. I don't even know if that's a word, but I was, you know, just not in my body at all. And having, you know, just had a baby, I was doubly not in my body. But in a weird way, this movie was kind of a salvation for me, because Sophia is such a tender, present director and friend. And to land in this world for a couple months when I was kind of going through the hardest period of my life, it was like a real gift for me, because I think I would have probably just been like floating somewhere, you know, in the chaos of my own emotions. So in a weird, very weird, bittersweet way, this was like a really big blessing for me to have this movie to go to.
Were there things in the film that you could connect to the emotions you were experiencing and express what you were feeling through this other character?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think the thing that's the craziest about birth and death is just the utter rawness of feeling. Like, I still feel this way. And I think it's like something cracks in you. It's very binary. Both things, like becoming a mother and losing my mother, like, there's my life before and there's my life after. And strangely, there's something that's like not recognizable before those two things happened. And it's just this utter rawness of emotion where, like, doesn't matter where I am, what I'm doing, if I'm overwhelmed by that grief or that joy, that's it. Like, I have to feel that thing. I can't suppress it. I can't run away from it. It's just there. And, you know, that's a nice thing to have, you know, if you need it to go to, and if it's there anyway. So in that respect, I definitely felt moments like very connected to the way that I was feeling. And then I think Laura, you know, she's got this sort of low level melancholy happening, where she's not necessarily depressed, but I think she's searching and she's kind of in this midlife crisis. I wouldn't even say crisis. It's more just like a questioning about, you know, her own self-worth and her own relationship to her life. And all those things I really relate to. And I think nothing brings that into starker relief than, you know, birth and death.
Your character in the movie, Laura, she's a wife and a mother and a daughter and a writer who can't move forward on her book. She's stuck and she starts to not recognize herself. And I think she, part of it is her fear that her husband is having an affair, but part of it is her life isn't the life she used to have. She's become like the homemaker and the mother, and there's a lot of responsibilities with that. You said that, you know, losing your mother and becoming a mother, they were both binaries. They both had like before and after. Did you go through a period of feeling like you didn't recognize yourself anymore and you had to figure out, well, who am I now?
I mean, are we saying that that period is over? Yes. I do think that there's these like big chapters of life. I remember feeling this way a little bit in my late 20s, really having like these deep questions about who I was and like not recognizing myself. And then I feel like I've kind of returned to that a bit in the past couple of years, where like probably not as strongly as my 20s, because I think in your 20s, you're like really not quite sure how it's all going to pan out. Now I'm halfway through. Like I can't pretend that my life isn't the way that it is, and it's great, and I'm very grateful for it. But I think my relationship with the world and kind of how I see my life unfolding from here on out and what's important to me, and to be honest, my relationship with death, because that's something that really kicks off, I think, in the middle of your life, where, you know, you're invincible until then. And then all of a sudden, you know, you lose the person you love the most, who brought you here, and you wouldn't be here without them. And it really incites this much larger thing, which is like, okay, how do I live my life in a way that will honor my death, my inevitable death? And I know that sounds so heavy, but it feels like culturally, I never even considered that. Like everything is about like living like you're young, pretending you're never going to die. And as my dad always says, like live every day like it's your last and one day you'll be right. There, you have to sort of like now contextually think about your life in the context of your death. And it to me, that makes a lot of sense, and it should be. It should be respected and almost celebrated in a weird way. So that's where my head is now.
My guest is Rashida. Having two parents in showbiz, was your early inclination to find a place in show business yourself or to stay away from it?
To stay far away from it. I didn't succeed, obviously. But yeah, I wanted to go to law school. I wanted to be a judge or a lawyer. And my rebellious identity as a young person was like studious, crossword puzzle loving, you know, I love the idea of like maybe being a humorist or like a novelist and a humorist or a lawyer. I don't know how those things relate, but either way, I love the idea of having like academic structure behind, you know, my identity and my self-worth. So I was like, for sure going to go to college, for sure going to go to an Ivy League school, for sure going to get out of LA, have nothing to do with showbiz, you know, go pursue something legitimate. I say, as I sit in my house in Hollywood, California.
I love the idea that being studious and academic minded made you rebellious. Like that was your rebellion.
It's pathetic. I know.
No, I think it's really interesting because, I mean, your parents were celebrities. And so what was it that you didn't want that you saw in the world of like celebrity or show business?
There's so many things I didn't want. You know, I have a very, very healthy perspective on fame. And I think a lot of people who pursue things that have either fame as in kind of incidental kind of side challenge or actually pursue fame don't really know what it's like. I've seen it all. I've seen the ups and the downs. I've seen people rise to success and everybody orbits around them. And then I've seen it all go away. I've seen people handle it well. I've seen people handle it poorly. And I think specifically with my parents, you know, my dad was always notable and well-respected. And then when we were kids and my parents were together, he became really famous, recognizable because of the Grammys. He won lots and lots of Grammys with Michael Jackson for Thriller. And all of a sudden, he was like a famous person. And even though my mom had experienced a lot of fame as a young actress, she sort of like put that aside. She decided she didn't want that. And she gave it up to raise us. and to just kind of be in her family. So that when that happened, it felt like it changed the dynamic of our household, and it changed my dynamic with it, because I think in some ways I've always thought that fame has very, very difficult consequences. And I don't think every family, and I don't think every person is designed to carry the weight of fame. I think people think it's this wonderful, magical heal-all, and it's actually the opposite. It's like, it can be a poison. It can be intoxicating and destructive.
Yeah, I mean, your mother says in your documentary about your father that after The Color Purple, which he worked so hard on writing the music, that he had given away parts of himself before, but that after that, like, there was nothing left. He was just depleted. He'd given it all away. And she found that very upsetting, and I think implying that there was nothing left for her. And that's when she ended the relationship. So it sounds like, you know, fame was part of the reason why your parents separated.
Yeah, I mean, he's a workaholic too. I think fame is a part of that for sure, because fame intensifies, you know, what people demand from you. So if you're already, you know, susceptible to people wanting things from you and deadlines and, you know, being pulled on by that, fame doesn't make that any better, for sure. And I think, you know, my dad does belong to the world. He's always been that kind of person anyway. Like, even though he has to be internal and create and all this stuff, like, he loves people. He gets his energy from people. He loves to travel. He loves to, you know, meet all different types of people. In that way, he's perfectly suited for fame, you know, and he's good at it. He's really good at it. Not everybody's like that. And my mom was kind of an introvert, and it was hard on her. That was hard on her for sure. You know, I think it just was like the opposite direction of maybe where she thought her life was going, you know. But like all love stories, there's always these things that you don't negotiate until you have to.
Your mother, Peggy Lipton, was white. Your father, Quincy Jones, is black. Has being biracial affected the roles that you're considered for? And I'm wondering if you're ever considered, like, too light-skinned for a black role, or too black for a role that's explicitly or implicitly white.
All of it. Yeah, all of it. Inherently, being biracial, you just live in the middle. You just do. And I'm not complaining about that at all. It is just the way that it is. And the nice thing is that there is some part of that which makes you like a bridge, in a sense, because you kind of always feel like a bit of an outsider. But when I was younger, there was a lot less biracial people on TV and film. So I think people were confused, whether it was because they saw me or they saw my name on the call-in, you know, the sign-in sheet. They were kind of confused how to cast me. And I remember having like panic when I would get cast in something and I had to have a family, and I would have to have this discussion with the director or the writer or whatever and say, you know, I want to be represented the way I actually, my ethnicity is in real life. Like, I don't want to cover up anything or whatever. I mean, I think because my hair's naturally straight and my eyes are green and I'm pretty light skinned, the instinct is to not cast me as black. And I think as things have changed, and as there's more mixed families and more interracial families, things have changed. And there's a lot more understanding of all the different ways that biracial people can look, which is great. So there's a lot more kind of understanding, and it's less of a big deal now than it was when I first started acting, which is nice. And I think to be able to play now, to play roles where I get to be, you know, black and unapologetically black, like I am on Black AF, has been such a relief for me, because it's a whole side of myself that I haven't really gotten to play very often.
So your parents became a couple just a few years after the Supreme Court decision, Loving versus Virginia, which is the decision that did away, it abolished any state laws remaining that made marriage between a black person and a white person illegal. So how accepted do you think they were as an interracial couple? And we're talking about the early 70s here when they became a couple.
Yeah, you know, I think in the country, not very. And I think my grandparents, my Jewish grandparents from the East Coast at the beginning had a hard time with it. And then they loved my dad so much that they got over it. But I think a big part of their existence in California was there was this like beautiful kind of like utopian enclave. Like we had all these family friends. Like if you had asked me at age six, you know, if I knew that, you know, 15 years prior it would have been illegal for my parents to be together, I would have no idea because we had, you know, all these friends. We had a lot of interracial families that we were friends with, like Sidney Lumet and his wife and Sidney Poitier and, you know, Dickie and Minnie Rudolph, Maya Rudolph's parents. So we had all these, you know, my parents did a very good job of surrounding us with people that looked like us and had similar families to us. So it didn't feel weird to us.
So you know Maya Rudolph as a kid?
Yeah, she was at my house the day I was born.
Wow.
She was like four or five. Yeah, our parents were really good friends.
Were you good friends?
Yeah, we are good friends.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, she's the best. The best.
So finally, when I see QAnon referred to as Q, I think, like, I remember when Q just meant your father.
I know.
Now it's just like conspiracy theory group.
Oh, no.
What's that like for you to see Q all the time now?
Listen, Q will always be my dad. I don't. Whoever that other person is might not even exist. So they don't get to take the thunder. And hopefully, the legacy of my dad and his, you know, enormous life and contribution will be the only Q that people remember. Hopefully, this will fizzle out.
Rishita Jones, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Rishita Jones stars in the new film comedy On the Rocks, which is streaming on Apple TV+. Her documentary about her father, Quincy Jones, is streaming on Netflix, as is her latest TV series, Black AF. The new film, Judas and the Black Messiah, revisits the events leading up to the 1969 death of Fred Hampton, leader of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. Hampton is played by Daniel Kaluuya from Get Out, who recently received Golden Globe and Screen Actors Guild Award nominations for his performance. Our critic Justin Chang has this review of the movie, which is in select theaters and streaming on HBO Max.
There have been many strong documentaries over the years about the history of the Black Panther Party, but Judas and the Black Messiah is the first major Hollywood drama I've seen that puts the organization and its activism front and center. That speaks to the timidity of the American film industry, which often prefers simpler, more reassuring stories about racial justice, and which is seldom comfortable with Black Panthers unless they're of the Marvel comic book variety. For this reason alone, Judas and the Black Messiah, directed by Shaka King from a script he wrote with Will Burson, already feels like something of a cinematic breakthrough. That it's smart, powerful, and well-acted almost feels like a bonus. The movie focuses on the last year or so in the life of Fred Hampton, the chairman of the Panthers Illinois chapter. He was only 21 when he was killed in 1969 by Chicago police during a raid on his apartment that was planned with the FBI. One of the virtues of Judas and the Black Messiah is that it gives us such a captivating sense of who Hampton was. He's played here by an electrifying Daniel Kaluuya, who captures the young man's gift for inspiring other activists and his ferocious critique of the nation's white power structure.
It's not a question of violence or nonviolence. It's a question of resistance to fascism or non-existence within fascism. You can murder a liberator, but you can't murder liberation. You can murder a revolutionary, but you can't murder revolution. And you can murder a freedom fighter, but you can't murder freedom. A revolutionary!
Early on in the film, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, played by a scowling Martin Sheen, identifies Hampton as a dangerous threat, a potential black messiah who will incite violence and empower other left-leaning political groups. And so the FBI enlists a young petty crook named William O'Neill, played by Lakeith Stanfield, to infiltrate the Black Panthers in Chicago and help bring Hampton down. O'Neill is thus the Judas of the title, and having the story unfold primarily from his perspective turns out to be a shrewd decision. As an outsider, O'Neill provides a natural point of entry. It's through his eyes that we witness the Panthers' work in their black communities, through free medical clinics and kids' breakfast programs. The more O'Neill learns about the organization, the more conflicted he feels about his mission. He knows better when his FBI contact, a very good Jesse Plemons, insists that the Panthers are as bad as the Ku Klux Klan. At the same time, the movie doesn't shy away from the Panthers' militancy as they march about wearing berets and openly carrying firearms. They're certainly capable of swift, merciless violence, as we see during an intense shootout with police. And when O'Neill hears about the torture and murder of a suspected mole in the party, he becomes even more fearful that he might suffer the same fate if his cover is blown. Stanfield's performance is remarkable. O'Neill starts off as an intriguing blank slate, and by the end is all but drowning in guilt, sorrow, and moral confusion. For roughly 2 hours, Judas and the Black Messiah sustains the pulse of a thriller, with an atmosphere that harks back to Sidney Lumet's gritty city crime pictures of the 70s and 80s. The director, Shaka King, has talked about the challenges of getting a Hollywood studio to greenlight a film about the Black Panthers, and framing the movie as a tense genre piece can only have helped. Some of the story beats can feel a little rote as a result, and many of the real-life Black Panthers we meet, like Mark Clark, who will die alongside Hampton in the 1969 raid, flash by too quickly to make an impression. But that narrative rush is also what gives the movie such momentum. Things do slow down for a bit of romance between Hampton and another Panther, Deborah Johnson, who's played with aching delicacy by Dominique Fishback. In one of the most moving scenes, Johnson reads Hampton a poem she's written, expressing both fear and acceptance of the fact that their life of protest will almost certainly end in tragedy. Like some other movies that have emerged this season, including Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and One Night in Miami, Judas and the Black Messiah is an ensemble drama in which black characters continually ask themselves, and each other, what form their liberation should take. You could call these movies timely, except that the issues they confront, from the exploitation of black American culture to white supremacy and law enforcement, have never not been timely. As Hampton notes in a speech that seems to describe this fractious nation at any given moment, America's on fire right now, and until that fire is extinguished, don't nothing else mean a damn thing.
Justin Chang is the film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed Judas and the Black Messiah, which is in select theaters and streaming on HBO Max. The world is on the precipice of cyber catastrophe, and everything is vulnerable, including our government, our nuclear power plants, elections, power grid, hospitals, and our cell phones. How we went from having the world's strongest cyber arsenal to becoming so vulnerable to cyber attack is the subject of my guest Nicole Perlroth's new book, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, The Cyber Weapons Arms Race. She's a cybersecurity reporter for the New York Times who has broken many stories. Her book describes how U.S. cyber weapons were hacked and used against us in ways we were unprepared for. Lately, she's been covering the latest massive cyber breach in which an adversary assumed to be Russia hacked into federal agencies, private corporations, and the U.S. infrastructure. The attack was launched in 2019 and went undetected until the fall, in what was described in her reporting as among the greatest intelligence failures of modern times. Nicole Perlroth, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with the recent massive data breach that was discovered in the fall that is still being investigated. Describe the extent of it.
Well, the biggest problem is we really don't know the extent of it. We know that it came in through software that's used by some 18,000 agencies, corporations, and that actually they did not hack all 18,000. They sort of picked and chose their targets. But in the United States so far, what we know is that this thing has hit the Department of Homeland Security, the very agency charged with keeping us safe, the Treasury, the State Department, the Justice Department, the Department of Energy, some of the nuclear labs, the Centers for Disease Control. And the problem is that they were inside these systems for so long that the chances are very likely, if not guaranteed, that they planted back doors. And so right now we're just understanding that they were inside for this long. We're still trying to figure out where those back doors are, and that could take months, if not years, to get to the bottom of.
For listeners not familiar with the term back doors, what are they?
Back doors are just code that, in this case, we assume Russian hackers planted, that just allow them a foothold to come back at another time. And they can be in the network, they could be stealing an administrator's password, they could have planted code in software in another application that lets them come in at a later date.
They may have hacked Black Start, which is the program for how the U.S. plans to restore power in the event of a catastrophic blackout. So that means if they did hack that, that if Russia causes a blackout, they could also prevent us from restoring the power grid. Do I have that right?
Yeah, so originally when this hack was discovered, one of the bright spots was that they believed that the hackers had not made their way into classified systems. But what I kept hearing from security researchers and people who worked at these agencies was just how much vulnerable data was in outside these classified systems. And one of those things was Black Start. So Black Start's just a very technical document that it's essentially a to-do list if we were able to have a major power failure. It says, you know, we're going to go turn on the power here first, then we're going to move out over here and do this. And with that document in hand, that could be very valuable for an adversary because it would essentially give them the perfect hit list to make sure that the power stayed off.
This story that you're describing about how many places were hacked by Russia, this is very dangerous. This leaves us really vulnerable. It shows how vulnerable we are, and they could have done so much more. The story has been reported. You've been reporting on it. Should we be a lot more upset and worried than we are as a nation?
Well, one of the things that people have said to sort of caveat the extent of this breach is, well, you know, this was designed for espionage. It really looks like they were after emails and documents. They weren't looking to exact some kind of sabotage. But the problem with that argument is they can use the same exact access they have right now for other purposes. And they have done that again in Ukraine. Ukraine has sort of been Russian hackers' test kitchen for a lot of these attacks. And, you know, the last time they pulled off a similar attack to this where they came in through legitimate software, they used it to pull off an attack that essentially decimated all of the data in Ukraine on government networks, but also kept people from taking money out of ATMs, kept people from going to gas stations, kept shipments from reaching their recipients, kept paychecks from getting to their recipients, and even at one point got into Chernobyl, the old nuclear site's radiation monitoring system. So we know what they are capable of with this kind of access, and that is the worst case scenario. But just sticking with what we know, which is they got into these systems for espionage, I mean, essentially what the Biden administration just inherited was federal IT networks it cannot trust. And that is a pretty difficult predicament to be in.
What has the speculation been about what Russia's motives are?
Well, I think right now what we assume they were doing was getting after emails and potentially trying to get as many sensitive documents as they could. So traditional espionage. Now, I should stop here and mention that the U.S. does these exact kind of operations, which makes it very difficult to try to calibrate a response. You know, how do you respond to an adversary doing to you what we have long done to them? But the question is, Where have they planted these back doors? When could they come back? How do we ensure they don't get into more sensitive systems, into classified systems? And, you know, another major target for this that we still really have only scratched the surface of is, did they get inside our critical infrastructure too? We know that a lot of electrical utilities used the same SolarWinds software that allowed these hackers to get into our government agencies. So right now, when you talk to these utility companies, they are just ripping out their software, trying to understand if they were compromised too, you know, what else touches their networks, where else are they vulnerable. So it's been a big wake-up call, not just for governments, but for critical infrastructure operators too.
The Russians got into our system in this hack through a cybersecurity company called SolarWinds. It's an IT management company. And SolarWinds products are used by the military, the Pentagon, the State Department, the Executive Office of the President, some telecommunication companies, even the National Security Agency. How did Russia use SolarWinds to hack all these systems?
What happened was these Russian hackers got into the build process at SolarWinds. This is the process whereby SolarWinds engineers create, test, and roll out their software to customers. And so customers all over the world updated their software just as we're supposed to do with the latest SolarWinds software. But instead of getting SolarWinds software, what they got was what we assume to be a Russian backdoor. And once they got into these systems of interest, they moved around and planted new tools that would allow them backdoor access to these systems and allowed them to crawl into things like their Microsoft email services, et cetera.
We are all told to use complicated passwords that aren't intuitive to protect our security. My understanding is that the password for SolarWinds was SolarWinds123.
That's right. And we're learning a lot about SolarWinds. I think SolarWinds is learning a lot about SolarWinds right now. They actually have a new CEO who just started. But what we learned was, yes, their security was just not up to snuff. We learned that they had really basic passwords. We learned that they were warned, you know, as far back as 2 years before this attack began, that if they didn't take their security more seriously, it could be catastrophic. Now, when I started calling up some of the victims of this attack, many of them didn't even know they used SolarWinds software until it came out that the company was breached and uses this Russian conduit. So what we were looking at really was a company that didn't have very good security, but that was touching some of the most sensitive systems we have. I mean, this was used inside the Pentagon, the NSA used it. We know that the Treasury used it and all the other victims that are coming out, including our utility companies. And one of the things that also struck me was, you know, most of their software build operations were not in the United States anymore, even. They were in Eastern Europe. Now, that's not to say Eastern Europe is fundamentally dangerous, but it's just interesting that only now, after the fact, are we learning that we had the software in most government IT systems built elsewhere that really didn't have good security practices in place. And now we're seeing the repercussions from that play out every day.
And what does it say that this breach was discovered not by our own intelligence community, but by a private cybersecurity company called FireEye?
Well, I think that's what makes this one of the biggest intelligence failures of our time. You know, what happened here was FireEye discovered that it had been hacked. And to its eternal credit, it came out with that right away. And as it started unwinding this attack on its own systems, it realized that one of the conduits to getting into FireEye's networks had been SolarWinds. And so it was able to basically alert Microsoft and all of these technology companies and the government that SolarWinds had essentially been used as a backdoor for this attack.
Do you think this does not speak well of our government's cybersecurity protections?
It does not speak well to our government cybersecurity protections. I mean, we are one of the most advanced, if not the most advanced, cyber superpower in the world. But we are also its most targeted and its most vulnerable because we are so virtualized here. And we have spent way more energy on offense, and by offense I mean hacking others, than we have on doing the really grueling and hard work to put up smart defenses. And there's never been a time that that hasn't been more glaringly clear than what we're unwinding now with the SolarWinds attack.
Do you know anything about President Biden's plans to deal with cybersecurity and to come to some kind of agreement with Russia and other adversaries that we won't attack each other and control the other country's infrastructure and power grid?
So we know that Biden has made cybersecurity a top priority. We know he squeezed $10 billion in additional cybersecurity funding into his COVID recovery bill. We know that he has brought this up with Putin directly in their first phone call. We know there are new positions that were created from the latest defense bill, and he's brought in Ann Neuberger from the NSA to essentially debrief him on just how bad the threats from cyber vulnerabilities are and to try and come up with a real working plan here. But what we also know is that the United States has been very hesitant to sign on to any cyber treaty or even any norms that would prevent the United States from hacking into the infrastructure in other countries. And part of this is just that the United States for a long time has been the most advanced player in this space. So by signing on to any kind of agreement to not hack each other's infrastructure, I think the theory was that we would be handcuffing ourselves. But right now, the problem has gotten so bad. You know, we know Russia has hacked our grid. We know that they have gotten into the switches that control the nuclear plants and power plants. We know that Russian cyber criminals have locked up our hospitals. People have not been able to get chemo treatments because of attacks on hospitals, cyber attacks on hospitals. So the problem has gotten so bad that I think there may be an opportunity here to come up with new rules of the game to say maybe, okay, we won't agree to hack each other's critical infrastructure, but you cannot attack hospitals. You cannot attack the controls at our nuclear plants without some kind of repercussions here, some kind of international repercussions. So that might be a good place to start, but I would be very surprised if we came up with or agreed to some kind of treaty that held us back. And one of the things U.S. officials will say is, sure, we could agree to a treaty, but the fact is that here when we do our own attacks, they're done inside Cyber Command at the Pentagon. In China and Russia and Iran, they outsource that work to contractors, to cyber criminals. And so even if those countries agreed not to pull off a grid attack, for instance, there's not much keeping these sort of lower tier contractors and cyber criminals for doing those governments' dirty work for them.
Well, Nicole Perlroth, thank you so much for talking with us. This has been very informative and also very chilling. Is part of your goal to be chilling, to say, hey, wake up, everybody, this is what's going on?
Yes, it is. Everything that can be intercepted here already has. You know, our intellectual property, our power grid, our nuclear plants, our hospitals have been taken hostage with ransomware. We are really in a very precarious place, but we haven't had that calamitous attack yet. And so the goal with writing this book and by putting it out now is, this is my own sort of attempt at a wake-up call to say, you know, we really need to make a decision as a society and inside government to stop leaving ourselves vulnerable. You know, we have to take our own security seriously. We also have to stop leaving gaping holes in software that could be used by adversaries to pull off some of these attacks. And so if my book is chilling, it's because I'd rather people read this and be scared and really think deeply about how they're securing themselves than waiting for that big wake-up call attack to happen.
Well, thank you for your reporting, and thank you for this interview. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Terry. It's been an honor.
Nicole Perlroth is a cybersecurity journalist at the New York Times. Her new book is called This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends.